All right, our next case is 10-1324, Superintendent of the Ohio Department of Insurance versus Ernst & Young, LLP, Foley & Lardner et al. Mr. Persson.
May it please the court, Chief Justice. My name is Stanley Persson. I represent the appellant, Ernst & Young, LLP. I would like to thank the court for the opportunity and the responsibility for arguing before the court today. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes. In the mid-1800s, this court recognized the benefits of arbitration. In 1931, the legislature adopted the Arbitration Act, which is in effect in place today. Thereafter, the legislature adopted the Liquidation Act. In adopting the Liquidation Act, recognizing that the language in the Arbitration Act referred to arbitration as a proceeding, the legislature permitted the liquidator to file proceedings to enforce claims, and indeed also when it came to the issue of mutual setoffs, said that mutual setoffs could be resolved either in an action, a court proceeding, or a proceeding. In 1990, the 10th District in Faby held that when the liquidator brought a third-party claim, the liquidator was subject to arbitration. The 10th District looked at the analogous bankruptcy law, which the Liquidation Act is modeled after, concluded that was consistent with its conclusion. The 10th District referred to the fact that proceedings were permitted in the Liquidation Act, and concluded that the language of the statute indicated that there was no irreconcilable difference between the Liquidation Act and the Arbitration Act in ordered arbitration. After that decision, in 1998, Ernst & Young entered into an arbitration agreement. They had an audit contract. And part of that was an arbitration clause which bound not only the insurance company, but any successors to the insurance company. So looking at the law, Ernst & Young thought it had a valid arbitration clause in the state of Ohio.
Is the Department of Liquidation considered under the law a successor or a statutory agent that is appointed by the government?
I'd say it's a successor, Your Honor. And what I'd do, I would point the court to 3903.18, where it states that the liquidator shall be vested by operation of law with title to the property, contracts, and causes of action of the liquidator. Indeed, the appellate court, both in Benjamin and in Hudson thereafter, held that the liquidator stood in the shoes. That's similar to what would be true under the bankruptcy law as well.
The legislature have the statutory power to override the arbitration clause and say by statute that arbitration clauses are not to be enforced and the action is to proceed in one proceeding in the court where possible?
Yes, the legislature has that power. And I will point out to your honor that, in fact, the Kentucky legislature utilized that power, and the Kentucky Act says you cannot have arbitration except on a reinsurance agreement.
And so in this case, you maintain that the silence as to arbitration allows it to go forward?
I think it's more than that, Your Honor. I think it's two things. One, there's no irreconcilable difference, which is how one interprets to see if there is a difference, that the Liquidation Act does not preclude correctly an arbitration. But more importantly, I think at least in several places, the Liquidation Act does two things. It uses the word action, which is a court proceeding, and it uses the word proceeding. And what it says is that you can have either actions or you can have proceedings. When it's recognized that the act was passed, when there was already the Arbitration Act, which referred to arbitration as a proceeding, I would suggest that it goes more than silence. I would say it reflects an indication by the legislature that arbitration was in fact to be permitted. And I might point out, Your Honor, that both the Colkin decision in Pennsylvania and the Costello decision in interpreting the Vermont Act relied upon similar language, as the appellate court did in Faby, talking about proceedings being permitted. So, Your Honor, I would say it's more than silence. I would say the legislature has affirmatively indicated that arbitration is permitted.
But the 10th District decision reversing that policy and saying no arbitration, how long has that decision been on board before this case came up?
The first case, Benjamin versus Pipperly, was in 2003.
And the legislature's never made any move to amend the statute to clarify that that's not what they meant?
Well, I think that's correct, but I also think it's correct to say that between 1990 and 2003, 13 years, the legislature never took any action to say that Fabey's interpretation of this statute was incorrect. I think there's some 10th District cases and some United States Supreme Court cases that say that the failure of the legislature to act in that situation cannot be read to really say quite anything. But if one is going to read it, I would, what I can say is 13 years is longer than 9 years. So the fact that the legislature did not act for 13 years, I would say, is more reflective of the fact that they thought liquidation
could be they didn't act for the first set of period of time because they agreed with it, and when it was changed, if they didn't agree with it, they could have acted, but they didn't.
Well,
they maybe didn't feel the need to ask for the first 90 years, and now the law's changed. But if they didn't act again, maybe they don't mind the change.
I think the legislature, I guess to be candid with the court, hopefully I always am, the legislature sometimes acts and sometimes they don't act for all sorts of reasons. I will say this. I'm not aware that anybody has asked the legislature to act. And while to Ernst & Young this is very important, I think given the way the state of Ohio is going right now, as well as other states, there's enough things going on that it would not surprise, this would not be the first on the legislature's list of things to be done. But I think if you go back to the language of the statute, and I think one criticism I think one can make of the appellate court, not in Fabey, because if you read the decisions, they're quite different. The appellate court recently has referred to this as a matter of policy, that as a matter of policy, we think there's an inconsistency here. And I would submit, Your Honor, and to the court, that policy is a matter for the legislature. And the legislature, if one wants to consider policy, what's one to do? To start with the language of the statute. The language of the statute here permits proceedings to be brought. A proceeding, according to the Arbitration Act, includes an arbitration. So if one wants to read the language of the statute, it supports arbitration as opposed to detracts from arbitration. And the same thing is also found in the set-off provisions, which in 3903.30 say that set-offs can be decided either in an action, which is a court proceeding, or a proceeding, which is something other than an action, which would suggest that arbitration was also okay for resolving set-off issues. But then, let's put that to one side for a second. Unless the statutes are irreconcilable, which is what the legislature has indicated in another statute, then the statute is to be given effect. There's nothing irreconcilable to permit arbitration. Arbitration has many benefits. As the appellate court held in Sasaki, it's much quicker. Given the burden docket, there are real benefits for arbitration. This arbitration clause is pursuant to the AAA, which is a well-recognized arbitration provider of panels.
Counsel, one of the arguments that liquidator makes, or the superintendent makes, is that you will create multiple proceedings or actions, and that sort of confuses the whole thing, and it acts contrary to intent to sort of centralize all of the resolution of all of these items. What is your response to that?
Well, I think they argue basically the set-off provision. And I will confess that if one reads the briefs, one does not see in the briefs that the word action or proceeding appears in the set-off provision, 3930. Because the word proceeding appears in that statute, not action only, I would submit that you can go ahead and decide the set-off in the same action, proceeding, the arbitration proceeding. So I don't think there is any overlap at all in terms of having two separate proceedings. I think that's the quickest answer. I think the other thing to point out here, there really was no set-off at all. I think it's also important to recognize that most courts that have interpreted arbitration acts and liquidation acts have found that claims brought by the liquidator against a third party is covered by arbitration. In fact, in the 2000 decision in Hudson, what to me was quite interesting was the appellate court stated the position we are adopting now is the minority position. So the court overruled a prior decision, adopted a minority view when the language of the statute, which the court didn't refer to when it overruled Fabi, specifically says a proceeding is something that can be brought by the liquidator. So I would suggest that there will not be duplicity. But I will also say this. It's interesting to note that there already is duplicity in this case. Because if one reads Benjamin versus Ernst & Young, which is a prior decision in this case, there was a claim brought by the Department of Insurance in its legal capacity, not as liquidator. And the court held that claim had to be brought in the Court of Claims. So right now, we are already in two proceedings because the department took the position this case can't be in the Court of Common Pleas. It has to be in the Court of Claims. So we are already in two proceedings already. And if the court orders arbitration, we'll still only be in two proceedings, the Court of Claims and in arbitration. Arbitration happens all the time when a malpractice claim, which is what this is a malpractice claim predominantly, is brought in the bankruptcy context, which is a point that the court in Fabi pointed out as well. So I would submit to the court that there is no irreconcilable difference between the Arbitration Act and the Liquidation Act, and the Court of Appeals had it correct when it decided Fabi, and it's not the province of the court to set different policy when there's been no change. And in fact, if anything, arbitration is much more accepted today than it was then.
Is it your strongest argument that this is statutory interpretation for us as to what proceeding means in that statute? Is that your strongest position?
I think it's the strongest position with a little bit of a hook in the end, and that is the other question is irreconcilable.
Pardon me?
The question also is it irreconcilable? I think is it arbitration, is having arbitration irreconcilable with the Liquidation Act?
What about the argument that the liquidator can disavow a portion of a contract? What's your view on that?
That it's sort of, it's not what the statute says. The Seventh Circuit in FDIC versus Ernst & Young involving the FDIC statute, which is also steps in as a receiver, under 1821, it represents shareholders as well and depositors. The Seventh Circuit said that's not what the statute says and would create all sorts of mischief. The statute says you can disavow a contract. It doesn't say you can disavow part of a contract. Again, in bankruptcy, which the Liquidation Act is modeled after, it's the same rule. Now, what the liquidator can do is the liquidator can disavow an entire contract. And that's how you get out of the contractual obligations you might have. You cannot disavow part of a contract, and that's the plain meaning of the statute. I'm not aware of any case which says you can disavow part of a contract, and the bankruptcy cases and the FDIC versus Ernst & Young both say you cannot do that.
And that's the proposition of law you're advancing, that it has to be all or nothing. You don't get the benefit of a contract and sever arbitration if you're taking the contract or using it as a potential claim. You take it as it is with an arbitration clause if there is one.
Exactly, Your Honor. You have your choice. You can take it or you cannot take it, but I think quoting one court, you can't cherry pick it.
Counsel, I'd refer you to section 2711.01A, which is, I think, appended to your brief. And just looking at that, it says any provision in a written contract to settle by arbitration is enforceable except upon grounds that exist at law or in equity for the revocation of any contract. That would appear to say that clause could be revoked. If you could revoke the whole contract, you can revoke that clause without revoking the rest of the contract. That does not have the meaning that it would first appear to have?
No. I will say that nobody has, in this case, has argued that provision has any application here. But I will say no. What you have to have is a grounds that applies to all contracts, not necessarily that's akin just to the arbitration clause. So if there's something that said contracts were not permissible, could not be enforced, could be revoked, you could do it, but you can't just take a clause out of a contract.
So if you revoke the whole contract, the arbitration clause goes along with it.
Exactly. And I think if the liquidator had revoked the whole contract here under the Liquidation Act, then you might not have a problem under that statute as well. But that's not what occurred.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Kearney.
Good morning, Madam Chief Justice, and may it please the court. When the superintendent liquidates an insurance company, she cannot be compelled to abandon the public open court liquidation court process based on a private agreement that she never signed. That's true for all types of claims, but three types of claims are relevant here. One, general claims by the superintendent against any third party. Two, preference claims, which are a unique claim that only spring to life once there's a liquidation. And third, claims that are filed against us. And the last type of claim, although I acknowledge they haven't filed one, is important, because if you're looking at how the statute works for all cases, if you start with the simple case, it makes all the other cases fall into place. If they simply had not been paid, and they said, we want to be paid, if you followed literally their view that we're in lockstep as a successor in interest, they would be able to point to that, and even if they had a contract that said, forum selection in the states of Illinois, Illinois choice of law, go to Chicago, of course the statute here in liquidation trumps that, because it says Franklin County, it says your claims against the insurer are extinguished and replaced by a right to file a claim. Your statute of limitations to come out against us are set by a liquidation order that says everybody file in 6 months, even if you had a 4-year or a 6-year or 10-year claim. So by definition, before we get to arbitration, we know that we are not some sort of lockstep successor in interest, because lots of things that are in contracts are wiped away and we start fresh and we say, everybody get in line. And it would be preferential if somebody could keep all their money granted by a private arbitrator when everybody else has to get in line, see what their priority is, and maybe take a haircut.
They maintain that the arbitrator can deal with set-offs. Do you agree with that?
No, not at all, Your Honor, because that would be directly violating, because a set-off by definition means claims running on a two-way street. We claim against you, you claim against us. The rule says if you have a claim against us, basic breach of contract, you didn't pay us, that's extinguished upon the liquidation order and replaced by a right to file a proof of claim. If you were to say, but I have a contract from pre-liquidation, no, that's extinguished on day one. Your set-off.
They have a set-off? Have they claimed a set-off?
They have not, Your Honor, but here's where it's important, not only to look at the group of cases, because we don't want splits, and they acknowledge they want it under one roof, but they say even set-offs would go to private arbitration instead of both under the liquidation court. But also, we have raised a preference claim, which they haven't talked about. A preference is a unique thing that says, we're not necessarily saying you got the money improperly, although we do allege that, but anybody who got paid in the final year, when the company was insolvent but hadn't been put in liquidation yet, we claw back that money, and then you get in line, and you might get it back, but you have to prove it. We have a preference claim that says the $25,000 you received in the final year before liquidation, give it back, throw it in the pool, and get in line with everyone else. If that preference claim were honored as it's supposed to be, then they would have to have a claim against us to get their payment back, to get their $25,000. And a preference claim, notably, under the statute, it says, shall be brought in the Franklin County Court of Common Pleas, period. That language they keep pointing to under the general superintendent pursuing claims that says, or in any other action or proceedings in this state or elsewhere, that language is not paralleled. It contrasts. In the preference situation, it's not there. They cite one case from the 70s.
Why couldn't they have proceed to arbitration, get their judgment, and then you take that judgment and you put it in your lineup with your preferences?
Because, Your Honor, several reasons. First, once you have an order from an arbitration court, then all of a sudden that triggers all sorts of problems because of the deferential standard by which we view arbitration awards. You can't do that on the back end. You have to, on the front end, say that doesn't get sent out to arbitration. And second, although they say set-offs are often separate issues, That's not so. A lot of times you say, the reason we're not paying is because you didn't do the job right, or you gave us bad office supplies. You know, a lot of times the reason for non-payment is the same as some sort of tort or negligence or other claim. So you can't have the same issues be decided on this side of the street by the liquidation court, while meanwhile some private arbitrator somewhere is deciding overlapping issues. Because the rule says if there's a set-off, you only pay the balance. You have to put them together. And also, again, the preference claim. There's a rule that says if anyone has a claim against us, they have to give back their preference and then get in line for the claim. If you segregate those two, you can't do that tit for tat. And I also want to point out that this is set up by the legislature as a public process where the superintendent is told by statute you are to protect insureds, creditors, and the general public, not shareholders. As this court knows from, you know, Petrosurance in recent cases, shareholders are at the bottom of the list in any priority situation. If we were stepping in the shoes for all intents and purposes, we'd be representing some ongoing corporate interest. We're not. We're out to get money for claimants. And every time we do a liquidation, we get flooded with calls. We have to set up a website and a call center because claimants, insureds, people who are looking for their money are wondering, when is this going to be wrapped up? It's set by the legislature to be a public process where everything is in the open, and we marshal the assets, and then everyone gets in line to pay. If you can have an arbitrator move you to the front of the line and get paid when everybody else is still waiting, or everyone else gets only a pro rata payment, or gets left with nothing because they have a lower priority, that undercuts the whole system. I also want to point out that
what would happen if they had already gone to arbitration before the liquidation? They had a judgment from an arbitrator. How does that play then?
That would be different, Your Honor, because then the arbitration would have been against a private entity. You're not dragging the liquidator into arbitration. If you had an arbitration award, or if you had a judgment debt, if you had anything. Now, if it had been paid in the previous year, you might have issues about preference and timing, but the general concept, forcing an insurer into arbitration is no problem. It's forcing the liquidator into arbitration. And she is, again, acting as an agent, not only of the legislature, but an agent of the court. The court basically is approving everything she does to go out and get this together and marshal all the assets together. Further, we know under general arbitration law, before you even get to the Liquidation Act, this court's arbitration cases say that the presumption is that a non-signatory is not bound at all. To rebut that presumption, somebody who wants to bind you has to show that you are a successor in interest. We are not, and the mere fact that even if you put aside arbitration, which we think is forbidden here, the mere fact that we break the chain, that we don't inherit the statute of limitations, we don't inherit forum selection, we don't inherit choice of law, the mere fact that so many other things get extinguished and replaced with a new scheme breaks that chain of claiming this lockstep, you're everything they are. I mean, after all, if we were everything they are, that would mean if they had an agreement to extend the statute of limitations with the private entity, we'd be bound. But the Act says no, new statute of limitations set by the court. They can't claim lockstep. And as long as you start breaking down some of the fabric, that means they don't even meet the normal arbitration standard. I also want to note the point Justice Cupp brought up about the last clause in 2711 saying if there's a basis to challenge a contract, that would also flow through to a clause which is severable. They said no one's raised that. It's on page 24 of our brief, a full paragraph about it. But in addition to that, I want to point out that they say we've waived all these arguments because we've talked about standing in the shoes. That is wrong, both as a matter of procedure about what waiver means and as a logical contradiction they make.
Mr. Carney, under 3903.18a, opposing counsel had said that was the section relating to the successor in interest, the successor to a contract. Would you comment on that, please?
Yes. What it does is it says we take over the title to the assets, the property, everything.
And the contracts.
Correct. And what it then goes on to say, though, is throughout the rest of the statute, we don't get the statute of limitations, we don't get these choice of forum. It has all these other things. So the fact that the legislator itemizes, here's what you take and here's what you don't, means that you don't have this lockstep unity. They could have written it in one line.
It doesn't say you don't, you aren't subject to arbitration, does it?
It doesn't say that in those exact words, but it does say that the liquidator may sue in Franklin County or elsewhere. It gives her the option to sue elsewhere. There's a world of difference between giving someone following a government-mandated statutory purpose, an option to do something versus saying we're going to compel you to do so. But if it were a successor in interest theory, the legislature could have said, you succeed to all the assets and liabilities and rights and obligations of the company and have been done in one sentence. The fact that they itemize all those things, take the real estate, take the causes of action, but you can throw out contracts, but you can do this, shows that the legislature was setting up a system of some things carry over, some things don't. I also want to note, they talk about the 10th District case law and the back and forth. In those cases, when the court did say offhand, stand in the shoes, for example, in the Pipoli case, in paragraph, I believe it's 53, the court does say stand in the shoes, but the full line is, while this court has recognized the principle that the liquidator stands in the shoes of the insolvent insurer, the Liquidation Act also confers upon the liquidator special powers, and then it goes on to say, while you do, partly, and then it goes on to explain all the ways we don't. I also want to point out, in that 13 years of the so-called FABE regime, the era where in the FABE court, they did say once, we'll let it happen. They didn't say we will automatically enforce in a bright line way favoring people seeking arbitration. They said we'll call balls and strikes by the trial court's discretion. And in those 13 years, the 10th District in both Covington v. Lucia and Covington v. American Chambers, this very same liquidation, both times the 10th District said no arbitration here would mess with the liquidation. No arbitration here would mess with the liquidation. Finally, then the court said in Pipoli and in two cases since, no arbitration at all because of the unique role and the statutory function. But along the way, when they'd said, well, let it happen, they actually kept denying it in applying the standard several times, including in another party that was fighting against the same defunct insurer. So throughout those years, I also want to note, they haven't mentioned their tolling agreement, but throughout that process, the tolling agreement could not have relied on FABE as this bright line rule because, again, it was a jump ball left to the trial court. And on top of that, anytime, for example, when a party files a complaint, that doesn't freeze in time tort law or contract law or any law. If this court makes a new decision and somebody's coming up the chain, unless a statute changes, that's different. But if the common law changes or if interpretations of a statute change, people take that, and you take it as it comes, and new law applies. And so if the 10th District evolves its law or this court changes the law, you're not frozen in time by a complaint. And just because you reset the mandatory complaint date by 2 years doesn't change that. You're just in the same place as you would have been with a complaint date. You bought
Mr.
a little
Kearney,
more time.
If I understand the argument that's being advanced by Mr. Parson, he focused our attention on the term proceedings.
Correct.
It's in the statute. And I know in 3903.21 it says that a superintendent is authorized to prosecute and commence any and all suits and other legal proceedings. It seems to me, if I understand the argument he was advancing, which I'd like you to address, that the term other legal proceedings would include an arbitration proceeding.
Well,
so the first argument I'd like you to address is, what weight should we give to the term other legal proceeding in that statute?
I think
the second argument I want you to address is the argument in the proposition of law that says a liquidator may not disavow a portion of a contract, but only the entire contract. So could you take those two and
sure.
address
Sure.
On
those? The first one, the clause you read, I believe, started with the superintendent may commence a proceeding. So before you get to the word proceeding, it's that the superintendent may. So she may initiate. If the liquidation order says yes and the statute says yes, you may go elsewhere to Illinois or even perhaps in a rare case to arbitration. She may commence. That doesn't mean she may be dragged kicking and screaming. There's a world of difference between saying a government-directed statutory power that says someone may do something means they have to, particularly when it's based on someone else's commitment. Because again, the normal arbitration background principle is you're not bound as a non-signatory unless you show successor and interest lockstep alignment. Because we don't have lockstep alignment, we can't be dragged, and a clause that just says we may commence elsewhere doesn't change that. I also want to mention, they mentioned other cases in the past where we've gone elsewhere. The jump case they cite from Missouri was under the old statute, 1978, before this language was in here. They also cite, for example, the Kentucky statute. They get it wrong. If you compare the block quote in Stevens, the Second Circuit case, to the block quote from the newer Clark case last fall, the legislature in Kentucky in 1996, the year after Stevens, removed the express language against all arbitration. They did put in language blessing arbitration for reinsurance, but there's no express barrier. If there were, the Clark decision last fall would have been one paragraph. There's an express barrier, end of story. Instead, the court in Kentucky went on for pages and pages talking about all the same things we're talking about. The need for centralization, the need for a public purpose, all those things the Kentucky court reached because there isn't a bright line barrier here. And as to the second question, I'm sorry, that first question involved a lot, but
disavowing a portion of a contract.
We are not relying on the disavowal power here in this sense. While that does show that we're not a lockstep successor in interest, because a normal successor in interest in the corporate sense can't pick and choose contracts, we're not primarily relying on disavowal because the statute comes in and trumps it. Let's say, for example, you had a contract that says, here's the choice of law, here's our agreed extended statute of limitations, here's our choice of forum. If you had all that stuff and we came in and just said, nope, the statute trumps, we wouldn't be triggering the disavowal power. We'd just be saying there's a different statute about where all these things come in. And the fact that the statute trumps them means we don't have to use the disavowal power because the statute says Franklin County. I see that my time is up. I just want to point out again, under normal arbitration law, they have to show we're lockstep, and so many pieces of the statute take it away. This is a public process designed to keep things in the open for the benefit of creditors and the public.
Thank you, Mr. Kearney.
Thank you.
Mr. Parson, you used all of your time. You may have 30 seconds.
Talking about the specific issue, we've got a malpractice case. There's nothing in the act that precludes arbitration. The liquidator had a choice. She could have disavowed the contract. She did not. She then is bound by that contract. The statute permits her to bring a proceeding. With regard to the tolling agreement, yes, the law can change. But the law can change so that it affects people's contractual rights. The law cannot change like that under this court's decision in Peerless. There was an arbitration agreement. There was then a tolling agreement. The tolling agreement preserved Ernst & Young's rights as of the date of that agreement. And it very carefully said, as of the effective date.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
We will take the matter under advisement, and the parties will be notified of our decision. Thank you.